of the state, and tonight I thought I'd talk about some aspects of Rothbardian analysis of money and banking. And by the way, the real expert among the Misesians on this today is Joe Salerno. And I got one book I didn't mention is he has a new book of essays on in the past year or so anyway, maybe the past 2 years. And I would recommend that one also. Maybe Cam can dig up the link for it. I forget the exact title, but it's a collection of Joe Salerno's essays on money and banking over the years. And they're all just really excellent. And so I would recommend that one also, in addition to the ones I put on the list. But I thought I'd hit some of the high points, what I consider some of the high points of what Rothbard had to say about money and banking. And of course, he wrote so much. He wrote a treatise, one of the few treatises on monetary theory, the history of money and banking in the United States. And there really are very few. There's that, and there's the famous Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz book entitled The Monetary History of the United States. And there's another treatise by Richard Timberlake. And then there's a history of the Fed by Meltzer, an economist that named Meltzer from Carnegie Mellon. And that's about it as far as treatises go. There are lots and lots of books on money and banking. But as far as a treatise, it is sort of an overall analysis of monetary theory and so forth. Now, those are the ones. And, of course, the oldest that I recommended already is The Theory of Money and Credit by von Mises. It was published, I think, in 1912. But as far as modern treatises, there aren't too many of them, three or four, and Rothbard's is one of them. And so I'm going to just touch on a few things. He wrote so much about money and banks and the Fed and so forth, and we don't have time to give a broad overview of it all. But the first question that he poses in the writings that I put on the syllabus for tonight is a very good one. Is that he talks about the secretive nature of the Fed, and the Fed surely is secretive. That's why Ron Paul tried mightily for the past several years to get legislation passed that would audit the Fed, and he was met with ferocious opposition by the banking industry and by Congress itself. But the main question is, if what the Fed does is really in the public interest, why can't the public know anything about what it does? Why does it have to be secret? Politicians are always bragging that what they're doing is only serving the public interest. Well, then why can't the public know about it? No other institution is so secretive as the Fed. And that, of course, is the key question. You know, why is it so secret? And, of course, it's a rhetorical question. And the answer is, it's so secret because you know they're up to no good. You know you smell a rat whenever the government goes to such extreme lengths to hide and disguise from the public what they're doing. And not only are they tight-lipped about what they're doing, but a lot of what people think they know about the Fed is propaganda, self-serving propaganda by the Fed and its spokespersons. And its spokespersons includes probably the majority of economists who write on the issue of monetary economics. The next big fable surrounding the Fed that Rothbard talks about is what I call the myth of the independent Fed. The Fed has always maintained that we, the people, should not have a right to audit its books or see what it's up to, because that would politicize the Fed. And it calls itself an independent government agency, independent of politics. But of course, a government-run institution that is independent of politics is kind of like a cat that barks like a dog or a dog that meows like a cat. Now, there's no such thing. Now, the Fed has private shareholders, but the head of the Fed, of course, is appointed by the president, and as are the members of the Fed board. And so it is controlled by politics, to be sure. And the Congress does have an indirect role there, in that the Senate has to confirm the presidential appointee, and so the members of Congress make it known to the president who is and who is not acceptable as the candidate to head up the Fed. And so indirectly, even though the president appoints the chairman of the Fed, indirectly Congress has a very important say as to who the candidates will be, who the appropriate acceptable candidates will be to head up the Fed. And now on the idea of the independent Fed being a myth, I recommend my article that I already mentioned on the chat. It's called The Myth of the Independent Fed. And I presented this as a paper, a different version of it, as a paper at the Mises Institute conference on the Fed, I think it was 15 or 17 years ago, quite some time, in Jekyll Island, Georgia, at the Jekyll Island Club, where the Fed was created. And so I wrote this up eventually, and it was published originally in the Freeman by on the website of fee.org, fee.org. And then I had Lou Rockwell reprinted on lourockwell.com a couple of years ago. And it's been all over the web on Ron Paul's Revolution Path website and a few other places. But what I did was basically surveyed some of the economics literature that shows that the Fed is in no way independent of politics and never has been. How could it be? It's a political institution. And in particular, I cited an article that was published in April 1978 by an economist named Robert Weintraub, who was a very good applied economist. He worked for the Congress at the time. And he showed how the Fed fundamentally shifted its monetary policy from easy money or more expansionary monetary policy where the money supply grew faster to a less expansionary monetary policy where the money grew slower in 1953, 1961, 1969, 1974, and 1977. These were all years in which the presidency changed hands. And so in most of these years, you had the same Fed chairman. And of course, each Fed chairman is like you and me. If they have a job, they want to keep the job. They don't want to be fired. And so what do you have to do to not be fired as chairman of the Fed? Well, you have to please the person who can reappoint you and allow you to keep your job. And that person is the president. And so as different presidents would come in, they would announce in their speeches what their preferences were for monetary policy. They did not directly control the Fed. They did not attend Fed meetings. But they and the members of the administration would go out and make speeches and talk on television and let the Fed chairman know what their preferences were. And so Robert Weintraub said, for example, President Eisenhower let it known in his speeches that he wanted slower growth of the money supply. He was getting concerned about inflation, price inflation. So the money supply grew at only 1.73% during his administration, which is historically very low. And then President Kennedy came in, and he announced publicly that he favored faster monetary growth. So the Fed accommodated President Kennedy and stepped up monetary growth by 2.31%. And then Lyndon Johnson became president, and he announced that he wanted much faster growth of the money supply to help monetize the debt that he was issuing for an expansion of the welfare state and financing of the Vietnam War. And so the money supply growth rate more than doubled during the Johnson administration. Okay. Probably the most egregious example that is mentioned by Robert Weintraub, though, is the Nixon administration. When Arthur Burns was the chairman of the Fed, and the money supply was already growing at 10.5% a year. Now, at that time, the monetarists were the most prominent spokesman for monetary responsibility for the Fed, and they were saying at the time that the money supply should grow, really no faster than GDP growth. So, if GDP is growing at 3%. The money supply should grow no more than 3 or 4% is what they were saying. It was growing at 10.5% in 1972, the year that Nixon ran for re-election. But Arthur Burns made sure that it grew even faster in the second half of the second quarter of 1972 to try to quote stimulate the economy faster. This is part of what economists call the political business cycle, where politicians do what they can to step up the money printing and the spending the closer you get to an election, in the 6 month or so period before an election, and the people will have a chance of remembering what the government has done for them lately, and then thank the incumbents in government, or so they hope, by voting for them for re-election. And so then President Ford comes in, calls for slower growth. He got it. He got 4.7 growth in the money supply. And so this is a very sharp contrast of what, for generations, economic students were taught about the activities of the Fed, and are still taught to a very large extent that the Fed is some sort of benevolent and omniscient, godlike, saintly organization. And for example, here's the most famous economics textbook from the 1940s into the 1980s was Economics by Paul Samuelson. Here's what the 1989 edition said about the Fed. It just portrays the Fed as an angel-like institution. It says, the Federal Reserve's goals are steady growth in national output and low unemployment. Its sworn enemy is inflation. If aggregate demand is excessive so that prices are being bid up, the Federal Reserve may want to slow the growth of the money supply, thereby slowing aggregate demand and upward growth. If unemployment is high and business languishing, the Fed may consider increasing the money supply, thereby raising aggregate demand and augmenting upward growth. In a nutshell, this is a function of central banking, which is an essential part of macroeconomic management in all mixed economies. And so its sworn enemy is inflation. Well, if you were to look at inflation since the Fed was created in the year 1913, the U.S. dollar is worth less than 1/20th of what it was in 1913, thanks to price inflation. And the central bank is solely responsible for the price inflation that we've had since then. So it really is a ridiculous joke. For an economist like Samuelson to say sworn enemy of the Fed is inflation. In Samuelson's mind it was, but not in reality. As Rothbard writes in his essay, on page 5, the overwhelmingly dominant cause of the virus of chronic price inflation is inflation or expansion of the money supply. And here's how he puts it very succinctly on page 6 of his article. He says, if the inflation undergone by Americans and in almost every other country is caused by the continuing creation of new money, and if in each country its governmental central bank, in the United States, the Federal Reserve, is the sole monopoly source and creator of all money, who then is responsible for the blight of inflation? Who, except the very institution that is solely empowered to create money, that is the Fed. And the Bank of England and the Bank of Italy and other central banks itself. So, of course, sworn enemy of inflation is the creator of inflation. And of course, I'm sarcastically saying sworn enemy of inflation, quoting Paul Samuelson. And so it's useful to understand the role of the Fed in the economy, to understand where money came from. And Rothbard does a very clear job of explaining where money came from. Money originally came from the free market. Money was not created by governments. It was not declared by any politicians. No politician ever declared that gold or silver or anything else would be money. It evolved spontaneously on the free market. And originally, people would barter, human beings bartered. If I'm a shoemaker and you're a farmer, I can trade my shoes for your food, for example. But of course, the problem is you might not have the things that I want. And vice versa, you might not need shoes at the moment. That's all I've got. And also, shoes are not very divisible. You might not want to give up that much food to buy a whole pair of shoes. And vice versa, I might not want to give up two or three pairs of shoes that I've manufactured at some expense to me for a tiny amount of food that I happen to want to buy this week to feed myself with. So it's not divisible, in other words, like money is. And so barter creates a problem in that people have to spend a lot of time trying to find other people who had what they wanted and to trade with them. If you need shoes, but everyone around you is selling eggs and cigarettes and car tires, you're out of luck. You have to search and search to find somebody who has shoes. Okay, and so people finally came up with the idea of using a common medium of exchange, something that they could denominate goods in as a source of value. And they used all sorts of things, historically, for money. Here's what Rothbard says about it. Once a good comes into use as money, the market expands rapidly, and the economy becomes remarkably more productive and prosperous because people don't have to spend as much time searching and searching for trade partners to trade for the thing that they want. And another big problem with barter, that is the absence of a monetary standard or a medium of exchange, is that there's no real way to to for businesses, for entrepreneurs, to figure out whether they're doing well or not, whether they're adding value by taking land, labor, and resources and producing products with them, or whether they're destroying value. Because what we measure is in terms of success or failure in business is profits and losses. And that's a monetary standard. And so it becomes very difficult to understand whether you're actually adding value or losing value. And so, and here's an interesting little sentence or paragraph about the types of money that has been used on the market in history, in human history. On page 8 of this article, Rothbard says, many commodities have been used as money, iron hoes in Africa, salt in West Africa, sugar in the Caribbean, beaver skins in Canada, codfish in colonial New England, tobacco in colonial Maryland and Virginia, in German prisoner of war camps of British soldiers during World War II, the continuing trade care packages soon resulted in money in which all of the goods were priced and reckoned. Cigarettes became the money in these camps, not because of any imposition by German or British officers or from any sudden agreement. It emerged organically from barter trading in spontaneously developed markets within the camps. So they settled on cigarettes as their medium of exchange. There's a famous article in the economic literature called The Economics of a POW Camp. It was published in the 1940s in the American Economic Review. It's probably online somewhere. It's been reprinted in 1,000 places. But it was used for many, many years in introductory economics courses to explain these things about the evolution of money, where money comes from. Because prisoners of war in World War II spontaneously adopted cigarettes as their medium of exchange. And so, but of course, historically, for thousands of years, for at least 3,000 years, what arose on the market was gold and silver. Human beings chose gold and silver as the most reliable forms of the medium of exchange, even though they've used all these other things, coconuts in the Caribbean and cigarettes and all these other things, had been in use. And so why is it? What are the traits of gold and silver? They're highly valuable, just on their own, they're highly valuable, and so they hold their value. Another valuable trait is they are limited in supply. They're not virtually unlimited like printed paper. And so, and that's a good thing because it maintains stability and value if there is some sort of limitation on supply. They're also in wide demand everywhere, and that's a virtue. Gold and silver are easily portable. unlike a lot of other things that historically were used as money, and they can be divisible. You can make gold coins, silver coins, and so forth in various denominations. And so those are the main traits of gold and silver that human beings for thousands of years decided was a good thing to have in terms of money. And Rothbard also talks about the Austrian school position on the big literature in mainstream economics on the optimum quantity of money. And that phrase comes from the monetarist school of economics that is most closely associated with the late Milton Friedman in the University of Chicago. But as Rothbard points out, talking about the optimum quantity of money makes about as much sense as talking about the optimum quantity of peaches or the optimum quantity of plums or raisins or anything else. Well, why is there an optimum quantity of anything? You know, what is the meaning of that? And he explains that, you know, once a society has adopted something like gold as their favored medium of exchange, there's no need to constantly increase the supply. There's something called the velocity of money, the number of times that a dollar turns over, for example, and the existing gold supply will be sufficient to be used as a medium of exchange as we turn over our transactions over and over again. And it's a virtue that gold mining doesn't produce any great explosions in supply of coal, because that would reduce the value of gold. We don't want that. That's an undesirable characteristic of money, the devaluation of it. So there is no benefit of a constant increase in supply of money, which the monetarists look at. In fact, there's a disadvantage. It devalues the value of your assets. It creates price inflation, and all assets held by people have become worth less and less. And, you know, why is that a virtue? The monetarists claim that's a virtue. And so here's how Rothbard puts it. An increase in the supply of money cannot relieve the natural scarcity of consumer or capital goods. All it does is to make the dollar or the franc or whatever cheaper. That is, lower its purchasing power in terms of all of its goods and services. All that an increase in the quantity of dollars can do is to dilute the effectiveness, the purchasing power of each dollar. Hence, the great truth of monetary theory emerges. Once a commodity is in sufficient supply to be adopted as money, no further increase in the supply of money is needed. Any quantity of money in society is optimal. Once money is established, an increase in the supply confers no social benefit. So there is no special optimal quantity of money, according to Rothbard and the Austrian point of view. And so, what has happened historically in a society based on a gold standard, the true gold standard, without government interference in the money supply? Well, here's how Rothbard puts it. I'm going to quote him again on page 11. And he says, the currency will remain of roughly stable value, not constantly stable value, but some people come up with a straw man argument that it wasn't 100% stable. Of course, nothing is that stable in the world. The currency will remain of roughly stable value. In a progressing economy, the increased annual production of goods will more than offset the gradual increase in the money stock. The result will be a gradual fall in the price level. Things getting cheaper. An increase in the purchasing power of the currency unit or gold ounce year after year. The gently falling price level will mean a steady annual rise in the purchasing power of the dollar or franc or whatever, encouraging the saving of money and investment in future production. Rising output and falling price level signifies a steady increase in the standard of living for each person in society. Typically, the cost of living falls steadily while money wage rates remain the same, meaning that real wage rates, that is, adjusted for inflation, or the living standards of every worker increase steadily year after year. That's what happens in a stable monetary system that is not based on perpetual money printing by a central bank. And so that, of course, is why politicians have always hated the gold standard. To this day, they speak nothing but vitriolic language for the most part whenever you mention the gold standard, because it doesn't provide unbounded opportunities for politicians to promise the people something for nothing by counterfeiting paper dollars. It's as simple as that. Another difference between the Rothbardian view and the mainstream view on money is the mainstream view of the monetarists is that money is neutral, that when the Fed increases the money supply, it will simply have the effect of increasing the price level, but it won't have any other real effects on the economy. Well, that's not true. It does create boom and bust cycles. And we're still in the bust segment of the boom and bust cycle created by the Greenspan Fed right now in the U.S. and in other parts of the world. But also it creates a vast redistribution of wealth. because the money created by the Fed is not dropped out of the helicopter evenly across an entire country. That's a silly experiment, a mind experiment that Milton Friedman came up with. Which really is inaccurate and the diversionary of the truth. Divert your mind away from the reality of what actually happens when the Fed increases the money supply. When the Fed increases the money supply by buying government bonds, for example, open market operations, it buys them from Goldman Sachs and other people on Wall Street for the most part. And so the money goes directly to the investment banks first and foremost. So the investment banks get that money and they bank it. They bank some of it. And so, automatically these banks get a big infusion of cash. And somebody's going to make a lot of money on this initial infusion of cash. You know, they got this money in terms of the bonds. So they're going to spend that money. And then the people who receive it spend some percentage of it. And then the people who in turn receive that expenditure will spend some of it and save some of it. So it creates a money multiplier effect. But eventually all that increased spending will push up prices. And so the people who get their hands on the money first make a windfall. They get an increase in money and profit, and they get to spend it on things before the prices have gone up. But by the time the money gets around through the multiplier effect to the ordinary person, prices have been driven up, and so your real income doesn't go up at all. And so there could be a massive redistribution of income based on who gets the money first. And Rothbard cites the French economist Richard Cantillon. And this effect is called the Cantillon effects in economics. His name is spelled Cantillon, Richard Cantillon. Mark Thornton has written at least one, maybe more than one, very good articles on Richard Cantillon and Cantillon effects. In the Review of Austrian Economics, either that or the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. I can't recall exactly which journal. So since it alters who gets the money, it also the Fed program also alters relative prices, the structure of relative prices in the economy, because we all spend money on different things at different times. And the mainstream Chicago school view of monetary theory is that there's only a sort of a uniform increase in the price level, no change in relative prices. Well, that's just not true. That's just not how it works. It doesn't work that way. And so those are some of the big differences between Rothbard and his view of money, his basic fundamental view of money, and the mainstream or popular view of money. And I guess he has, you know, one final statement that he makes there in this article. It says that he calls the Fed printing the money counterfeiting. He says, counterfeiting gravely cripples the moral and property rights foundation that lies at the base of any free market economy. And that's true. That's what Ben Bernanke is very busy doing today. And now the second part of what Rothbard does is he talks a lot about history in these readings that I gave you. And rather than just repeating what he says about his recounting of history, and there's a lot of it in this article. It's a big, long article. I think it's 88 pages or something like that. And, of course, Rothbard wrote many, many hundreds of pages on this topic. I thought I would give you a bit of an overview of the history of the adoption of central banking counterfeiting in the United States, since I've written a good bit about it also in several books, Hamilton's Curse being one, and then The Real Lincoln and Lincoln Unmasked. So my three books on Hamilton and one on Hamilton and two on Lincoln really cover a lot of the whole evolution of the development of central banking in the United States. And these books were all written in a way I hope is accessible to the general reader as much as academics. But the first attempt to create a national bank, a central bank, was the Bank of America. That was modeled after the Bank of England. As Rothbard says, the Bank of England was one of the early, very first central banks in the world. And so there was a faction in American politics known as the Nationalists or the Federalists. Alexander Hamilton was their intellectual inspiration for the latter years of his life. And they wanted to bring a Bank of England to America. Because they understood that the role of this bank was to provide cheap credit to their politically connected businesses, and these businesses in return would help make sure that they, the politicians, would maintain in power, would stay in power indefinitely. And so they would provide cheap credit and favoritism to business people who wanted to use government as a tool to expand their profits, even at the expense of the rest of society, if need be. And so this was a part of a British mercantilist system. There were all sorts of corporate welfare schemes. They were financed by British mercantilism. And the Nationalists, led by Hamilton, wanted to bring these mercantilist schemes to America. And the very first one was the Bank of North America. And it got a government monopoly on currency issue. But it became so unreliable, and was inflated so much that it lasted barely a year, and people totally lost confidence in the paper money that was issued, and so it had to be privatized. And so that was the first attempt. But almost immediately, Hamilton was, who was the sort of the political liaison between the New York, Philadelphia, New England merchant class, led by his mentor, Robert Morris, one of the richest people in America at the time, in the late 18th century. He was their political liaison in the Washington administration, and he was the Secretary of Treasury under George Washington. In fact, it was Robert Morris who got Alexander Hamilton the job as Treasury Secretary. There's a biography of Hamilton by Ron Chernow, Chernow, that won a Pulitzer Prize. And Ron Chernow explains how Hamilton got the job. He essentially, at the end of the American Revolution, wrote a long letter to Robert Morris, pretty much saying, I agree with your economic positions of corporate welfare, protectionist tariffs, mostly for the benefit of northern manufacturers, and a central bank to finance all of this. And so here is George Washington's right-hand man, Hamilton, his aide-de-camp in the Revolution, writing the richest man in America, saying, I agree with your brilliant economic ideas, and it was sort of hint, by the way, as if I needed a job and the war is over. And so, according to Ron Chernow, when he got this letter, George Washington got this letter from Robert Morris, he said to Hamilton, I didn't know you knew anything about finance. We never talked about it. But he appointed him as Treasury Secretary. And so one of the things Hamilton did right away was get to work lobbying for a resurrection of a national bank in the form of something called a bank. The first bank in the United States. And so he proposed that, and as did the nationalists or the federalists. And there was a big debate between Thomas Jefferson and Hamilton over the constitutionality of the bank. Jefferson's position was that we have banks. We don't need a bank run by politicians. They would be one-fifth capitalized by the government and then the rest privately owned, but controlled by politicians. We don't need that as a depository of tax revenues. We have banks. Hamilton claimed that the necessary and proper clause of the United States Constitution justified the creation of a bank, national bank, even though at the Constitutional Convention the subject had been brought up and rejected. That would seem to me to be evidence that the founders rejected the idea that a national bank was constitutional. But Hamilton made this argument anyway, and so George Washington eventually did adopt the Bank of the United States, but it wasn't because of the strength of Hamilton's argument. It was on the strength of a sleazy political deal. Washington owned a lot of land in Northern Virginia. Mount Vernon was the name of his home. It's a museum today. And the government was in the process of moving the national capital to Washington, D.C., to creating Washington, D.C., whereas the capital was in New York. And so Washington wanted the boundary of the capital to abut his property in Virginia. And he made a deal. I will vote for your bank, he said to the Federalists who wanted the bank, if you change the map of Washington, D.C. to make it adjacent to my property, thereby increasing the value of my property quite handsomely. And so they did. And so we got the first bank of the United States in 1781. It created 72% price inflation in the first 5 years. And it created boom and bust cycles. It corrupted politics like the Jeffersonian said it would, so that so much so that it was given a 20-year charter and Congress did not renew the charter at the end of 20 years because it had done what the Jeffersonians predicted it would do. And then came the War of 1812, and the War of 1812 was used as an excuse to resurrect the Bank of the United States. And so these people never give up. They never give up, and never did give up. And so the Bank of the United States was resurrected in January of 1817 to help monetize the debts, so to speak, of the War of 1812. And it promptly created the Panic of 1819. And the Panic of 1819 was the first really great depression in American history, where cities like Philadelphia lost thousands of jobs. Murray Rothbard's doctoral dissertation at Columbia University was entitled The Panic of 1819. It's published by the Mises Institute and it's online. And so, once again, resurrected the bank, it monetizes the war debt, it creates boom and bust cycle, and the greatest Great Depression in history up to that point. And so, when you get into the 1820s, President Andrew Jackson became sort of a mortal enemy of the Bank of the United States. he thought it corrupted politics and much worse than that. It created boom and bust cycles as it did. And so he became the big enemy of the Bank of the United States. And he waged a great campaign against the Bank of the United States, but he had lots of help. And among his helpers were the state governments. And so, one famous incident regarding the state governments is that the Bank of the United States opened up two branches in the state of Ohio. The state of Ohio did not want the Bank of the United States in its boundaries, creating mischief, creating boom and bust cycles, perverting its politics, and so forth. So the state of Ohio imposed the $50,000 per branch tax on the Bank of the United States. And the Bank of the United States refused to pay. And so the state of Ohio sent armed marshals into the bank vault, and they took $100,000 of the bank vault. And they were serious. And there were other states that did this similar things to try to tax the Bank of the United States out of existence. Maryland was one of them. There's a famous Supreme Court case called McCulloch versus Maryland that where John Marshall, who was a protege of Hamilton's and who was the Chief Justice of the United States at the time, issued the opinion that the Bank of the United States was constitutional. This is where he made the famous slogan that the power to tax is the power to destroy. And of course, yes, that was the idea. That's why Ohio and Maryland and other states imposed these huge taxes on the Bank of the United States and wanted to destroy it. They didn't want it within their boundaries. And so the states were battling the Bank of the United States, as well as Andrew Jackson. And Andrew Jackson, his role in it was to veto the rechartering of the Bank of the United States. And I'm looking here for a quote from Jackson, a good one. And so, and he did. He vetoed the rechartering of the Bank of the United States. And then when Chief Justice John Marshall issued his opinion, his personal opinion, that the Bank of the United States was constitutional, here's what Andrew Jackson said. He said, "To this conclusion, I cannot accept. Congress and the President, as well as the court, must each for itself be guided by its own opinion of the Constitution. The opinion of the judges has no more authority over Congress than the opinion of Congress has over the judges, and on that point, the President is independent of both.
The authority of the Supreme Court must not therefore be permitted to control the Congress or the executive when acting in their legislative capacity. So Andrew Jackson as president was essentially saying, thank you for your opinion, Mr. Marshall, but my opinion is different and it is equally valid as your opinion. And the members of Congress all have their own opinions too on the constitutionality of the bank, and their opinions are just as valid as the opinions of the Supreme Court. And so he pretty much thumbed his nose at the Supreme Court, and he vetoed the rechartering of the Bank of the United States. And Congress did not have the votes to override the veto, and so the Second Bank of the United States eventually went out of business as a depository of bank tax dollars in the United States, and it suspended its mission making and its boom and bust cycle making for a while. However, the government did not totally abandon its role in government regulation of the monetary system. There's still intervention. The Congress still intervened from time to time by suspension of specie payment. It would sometimes even encourage in various ways the creation of more and more banks to expand the money supply. And then it would pass laws suspending specie payment, which meant the banks were permitted to not hold reserves in gold and silver to give them back to the people who had presented the paper money, paper currency that had been issued by the banks. And here's what Rothbard says about this. In his book, What Has Government Done to Our Money? He says this. And the government, by the way, did this even when there was not a national bank. It did it through regulation. The bluntest way for government to foster inflation is to grant banks the special privilege of refusing to pay their obligations while yet continuing in their operation. While everyone else must pay their debts or go bankrupt, the banks are permitted to refuse redemption of their receipts, at the same time forcing their own debtors pay when their loans fall due. The usual name for this is, quote, a suspension of specie payments, end quote. A more accurate name would be, quote, license for theft, end quote. So what else would we call it? A government permission to continue business without filling one's contract. So license for theft is what Rothbard called this. And so we had a period from the 1840s, early 1840s roughly, to the 1860s in the United States with no national bank. But there was government regulation of banking. There were restrictions on branch banking through government regulation. There were periodic suspension of specie payments.
The next big expansion or nationalization of the money supply really took place during the Lincoln administration with the National Currency Act that created the greenback dollars that came to monopolize the currency and the Legal Tender Act. During the Lincoln administration. So there was a huge step in the direction of the nationalization of money supply. And also a special tax was imposed on state bank issued currencies. So there were competing currencies before that. But the special tax on state-issued currencies, along with the dominance of the greenback dollar, eventually monopolized the money supply at the federal level. And so this was not the resurrection of the central bank, but it was a big step in the direction of the nationalization of the money supply. The control of the money supply by Washington, D.C., and that, of course, is exactly what was wanted by these people. They bragged about it. Let me read you a quote. The sponsor of the National Currency Act in the 1860s. During the Lincoln administration was a Congressman Elbridge G. Spalding, a banker from Buffalo, New York. And he rejoiced over this, the fact that they were nationalizing the supply. And there's a historian named Richardson, Heather Cox Richardson, she quoted a New York Times editorial on March 9, 1863, that said this, quote, "The Legal Tender Act and the National Currency Bill crystallized a centralization of power such as Hamilton might have eulogized her as magnificent." So they were celebrating. The champagne corks were popping as far as that goes. Senator John Sherman, the brother of General William Tecumseh Sherman, was the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee during the Lincoln administration. Here's what he says was the objective of